Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 31st of August. Our guest this hour is Professor Edward Cohn, and he's the author of Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. Professor Cohn is a professor of American history and chair of the American Culture and Literature Department at Bill Kent University, and he joins us by phone today from Ankara, Turkey. He was named a top young historian by History News Network in 2007, and his previous works include The Kindred People. New York was staggered by a heat wave during which temperatures reached the mid-90s, and it was a 10-day heat wave, which began on August 4th, 1896. As you can imagine, there were a lot of people who were extremely poor, no air conditioning, of course. 1,300 people died in Manhattan and Brooklyn as a result of high temperatures, high humidity, and the unforgiving sun. He couples this story, terribly tragic story of what happened to so many people who were sleeping on roofs and next to the water and died when they fell to their deaths. The book also places the heat wave in the context of a particular moment in American political history, one that saw the rise of two young politicians, future President Theodore Roosevelt and 1896 presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Edward Cohn, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Nice to have you here. So do you really think that this heat wave had a great deal to do with the rise of Teddy Roosevelt?
Yeah, my point was never that this is something that put votes in his pocket and catapulted him to the White House. I believe that this is a step along the way into making Theodore Roosevelt the progressive president that he's going to become and the dominant figure of the progressive era.
Was he quite moved, do you think? Did this heat wave linger in his mind for most of his political life because of the drama of this and the horror of it?
I think so. I mean, one of the things he actually does is recounts in detail some of the sights that he saw during the heat wave years later when he writes his memoirs in 1913. That's almost 20 years later. So absolutely, I think his contact with the poor of New York tenements during this terrible tragedy is something that stuck with him.
And what was his position in New York at that time?
He was president of the Board of Police Commissioners, so he wasn't police chief. He actually held a fairly innocuous position. He was one of four police commissioners on what was kind of an oversight committee of the police department to make sure that things like hirings and firings were done based on merit and not based on your political connections.
Mm-hmm. And he was one of the few city officials who even suggested taking measures to help the poor during this weather that was killing people.
That's right. I mean, it's 1896 in the United States. It's decades before the New Deal, before the Great Society. Government at all levels rejects the idea that they have any responsibility to intervene in the economy or to help the poor. And so one of the themes of the book is that the city of New York does virtually nothing during the heat wave. One of the few department heads to do anything, to take any kind of proactive measures, was Theodore Roosevelt.
Why?
I think it was partly because of his long-standing belief in noblesse oblige. Mm. I think a lot of it has to do with his father, Theodore Roosevelt Sr., who was one of the great philanthropists of New York, establishing charities for homeless newsboys, for people who are differently abled. So I think this is something that Roosevelt always, during his career up to that point, thought was the duty, perhaps especially of the duty of the elites, of the upper class, of the better educated. And that's, of course, what the name Roosevelt meant in New York at the time.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about the people who were living in these horrendous tenements, what the living situations were like, and how New York's population had just really mushroomed in a short period of time.
That's right. New York and much of the country at this time is going through rapid urbanization, immigration, industrialization. The New York's population has boomed during this time. By 1896, one out of three of every New Yorkers is foreign-born, is an immigrant. And, of course, they are packed into these squalid, airless, sunless tenements on the Lower East Side. If it's a one-room tenement, that means one family is in that room. If it's a two-room tenement, that means two families. Rarely do you have access directly to running water. If there is a common sink out in the hallway, it's usually filthy, stopped up. Usually most people have to go down to the common hydrant outside.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a time when there is no air conditioning.
No air conditioning, no electric refrigeration. You literally have an ice box that you have to buy ice for. And in general, you know, working conditions, too, were so different. And most New Yorkers at the time weren't lawyers and stockbrokers. They were manual laborers working 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. New Yorkers literally worked themselves to death during the heat wave.
My. And these were workers. You talk about the elderly and the very, very young, but a lot of workers died because of heat exhaustion.
Yeah, that was the biggest surprise for me because I'm not really a social historian by training. And so it was only when I started looking at the death certificates and started to doing the tallies of age, sex, job, that I realized, you know, the majority, really the vast majority of victims were not the very young and the very old like I had expected. They were male, working age, otherwise healthy, working as manual laborers, probably an immigrant, and living in the tenements.
Mm-hmm. Now, the city, fill me in on this, the city changed their working hours so that they weren't, were they working still 10 hours a day, or did they stagger their work hours in response to this?
Yeah, again, that was another department head from the city who stepped forward and did something all by himself. And this was the Commissioner of Public Works, a forgotten hero of the heat wave. And he experimented a couple times trying to change the work hours for his men who were responsible for doing things like fixing the streets. So at first he tried kind of very early and then later in the afternoon to try to avoid, you know, noon, working from noon to two. But he quickly realized that still, even in the afternoon, it was very hot. So he altered his work hours again to make sure that his men did not work during the hottest part of the day. But this was not adopted for the entire city government, and it certainly was not adopted citywide. I think if it had been, this would have saved countless lives.
There's an amazing amount of callousness here, isn't there? It's as though these people don't even exist.
I think this is, you know, part of the story, perhaps, of natural disasters in American history.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're talking about the 1896 heat wave, a tornado in a trailer park, Hurricane Katrina, you know, I think these kind of disasters always take the greatest toll on, you know, those most vulnerable in American society. You have this huge population in New York living on the economic margins in 1896, and a disaster like this just pushes them over the edge, and they are pretty much without a voice at this time.
Mm-hmm. And talk more about the tragedy, people who were sleeping on the roofs, and what happened to some of them, people who went down to the piers to try to sleep, to catch some kind of breeze, and many of those people died.
That's right. These are some of the more bizarre deaths from the heat wave. One of the simplest things the city might have done would have been to simply lift the ban on sleeping outside in the public parks. And this could have been done with a stroke of a pen.
Oh.
How many thousands of people might have gone to Central Park and gotten a breath of fresh air, been able to get a decent night's sleep before they had to go to work the next day? The city did not do this. Thousands of New Yorkers literally slept in the streets, slept on sidewalks, slept on top of garbage bins, slept up on rooftops or down at the piers, with a tragic result that inevitably people would fall asleep, roll off, and roll to their deaths, either dropping five stories into the concrete courtyard below or rolling off a pier and drowning in the East River.
Goodness. And you start, I want to hear about the evolution of response, government response. And I know that Roosevelt's policies were being formulated at this time. But some of these quotes, it is not, you say in the book, in the province of the government to support the people. This comment from New York Governor Flower. President Grover Cleveland proclaimed that while the people should support their government, its functions do not include the support of the people. Clearly, the people were on their own.
That's right. And by 1896 as well, the United States is 3 years into a terrible economic slump, basically a Great Depression of the 1890s that began in 1893. And there are still, even in the 1890s, very few voices calling for government government action, government intervention. And it's really kind of a half-empty, half-full thing. Perhaps we shouldn't expect too much government action, you know, before the 20th century, before Social Security is instituted, before there's a social welfare safety net of any kind in the United States. And that's why I think something like Theodore Roosevelt's actions during the heat wave do stand out, because they could have been interpreted as a fairly radical idea at a time when nobody is really calling for anybody except private charities to do anything to alleviate the plight of the poor.
And let's talk more about Roosevelt's actions, how he took charge, what he did with ICE, etc.
That's right. Theodore Roosevelt championed the idea, fairly innocuous to us today perhaps, of giving away ICE to the city poor. ICE had actually been become a life-saving luxury at the time, because an ICE magnate, an ICE baron, had come down into the city from Maine and consolidated much of the ICE distribution and then jacked up the price of ICE, pricing it out of range for many people.
It's hard to even imagine such people existed when we think about our modern world. An ICE magnate.
That's right. And this is a major business in the city at the time. And, of course, the guy's name was Charles Morse. He did a fantastic business during the heat wave. He controlled about 75% of all ICE distribution during the heat wave. And this made him actually one of the few businesses in the city that wasn't absolutely devastated by the heat wave.
And you tell some stories of people buying ICE and then being ordered to go down 6 flights of stairs. By the time they get downstairs, they'd already paid for the ice. The ice is all melted, and there are fights that ensue.
That's right. I mean, the police records during the heat wave are a fantastic source for some of the strange and bizarre things that take place, almost some of the madness that takes over so many New Yorkers after living through 10 days of this excruciating heat. You know, often, yeah, ice would be delivered, and the iceman would look at, you know, 5 floors of a tenement that he was expected to walk up, and he would refuse. And while the two men were arguing over this, you know, this 10-pound block of ice sitting out in 95-degree heat out in the sun would become an ice cube, and, of course, a fight would ensue trying to get your money back from that ice.
And what was the role of newspapers in pointing attention to this and trying to afflict the comfortable, such as the ice magnet? Did they, or did they ignore the story?
No, this is a big story. This is, of course, the time of yellow journalism and the yellow press. You know, William Randolph Hearst and Pulitzer, they make a lot of money on lurid stories in the city of corruption or war or a natural disaster like the heat wave. So absolutely, while the New York Times is a bit upper crust and kind of looking down its nose at the squalid tenements and the dirty immigrant people that inhabit them, other newspapers are giving very sympathetic stories about the plight of the poor. And it was actually the yellow press early, even before summer arrived, that was saying, you know, look, because of this ICE trust in the city, the price of ICE will go up and people will die. And they are absolutely right.
Hmm. All right, let's switch to another part of the country, another rising political star whose fortunes are affected by this heat wave, and that's William Jennings Bryan, an extremely interesting figure in American political history.
That's right. If this heat wave is perhaps the most important forgotten natural disaster in American history, maybe Bryan is the most important forgotten politician in American history. This is a man who dominated American politics, especially in the Democratic Party, for 30 years. He ran for president 3 times. He was Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State in the early years of the First World War. And a lot of people probably still know him from the way he was depicted in Inherit the Wind, about
right.
the scope Phillips trial in Tennessee in 1925. In 1896, Bryan has just won the Democratic nomination the month before in July in Chicago, and he has the terrible limitation that he's really, in the end of the day, a congressman from Nebraska. He represents rural and agrarian interests, and he rails against the East, against places like New York City. So people in the East, including Democrats, view his candidacy for the presidency with great skepticism.
And he does this train trip, and this heat wave, we should add, is something that's really hit a good chunk of the country. So it's hit Chicago, and he's about to go to New York to give this major speech in Madison Square Garden, and the heat, as he travels, the heat's going with him.
That's right. It's almost as if he's the one who's bringing it to New York City. Bryan, his managers, make the strategic decision that to win over the East, he is going to make a dramatic acceptance speech of the nomination at a huge rally in Madison Square Garden. So he takes this long, slow train trip to New York City, across the plains in the Midwest, through the big cities of the East, giving speeches in all the tiny little villages along the way. Not only by the time does he get to New York City is he exhausted, his hands are purple and swollen from being shaken so many times, and his throat's not very good as well. And at the final nail in his coffin, he gives this important speech, perhaps the most important of his career, at a packed house at Madison Square Garden on one of the hottest nights of the year.
Mm. We welcome phone calls for our guest. Edward Cohn is our guest, and his book is Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. The other prominent politician featured in this book is William Jennings Bryan. Professor Cohn is an assistant professor of American history and chair of the American Culture and Literature Department at Bilkent University in Ankara, Turkey. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. We can, of course, talk more about this event, but there are other cities that have lived through heat waves and a number of deaths, actually, in years, even when there's been air conditioning, because people who are poor sometimes don't have air conditioning. How cities respond to that now makes a lot of difference. What about the European cities that had the horrendous heat waves a few years ago, and how political fortunes can rise or fall depending on how they respond or don't respond to these kinds of national disasters. Witness New Orleans, which has been front and foremost as we celebrate, or mark, rather, the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. We'd like very much to hear from you. Feel free to join our conversation anytime along the road here. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour of the program is the author of Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. Just a note about later today, as you know, tonight at 7, the president is giving a speech on Iraq from the Oval Office. We will have special coverage of that from NPR News as Iraq assumes its own security and the U.S. officially moves into an advisory and backup role. Robert Siegel will be with you tonight, along with NPR correspondents and senior editors, for live in-depth coverage and analysis, and that's tonight at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. We continue our conversation and welcome your calls if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. Tell me about what Roosevelt was thinking about his political future, what he thought about William Jennings Bryan. And you have some interesting stories about how he was maneuvering himself to be perhaps a part of a new administration.
Yeah, by 1896, unfortunately for Roosevelt, his career in New York City is probably at an end, which is kind of sad because he's a New Yorker born and bred, and this is where he makes his political bones in the Republican Party. But he's made some unpopular moves in the city by the summer of 1896. He's a Republican. Bryan's a Democrat. Roosevelt absolutely is supporting the candidacy of William McKinley for the presidency, and it is Roosevelt's hope that if he can campaign for McKinley, and if McKinley wins, Roosevelt will be rewarded with a new posting in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. And so he's meeting with, who are the people he's meeting with to just sort of court favor with them to make sure that his name is mentioned as a possible appointment in the administration?
What the most important is McKinley's campaign manager, Mark Hanna, after Bryan won the nomination, Mark Hanna canceled his summer vacation and personally came to New York City to establish the Republican national headquarters. Mark Hanna is a force to himself. He really helps during this landmark 1896 campaign to establish some of the very kind of modern-sounding aspects of presidential campaigns, like polling, like raising massive amounts of money, like sending out tens of thousands of pieces of campaign literature in a number of different languages. It's really Mark Hanna who is the kingmaker in New York City for the Republicans that year. So you bet. Theodore Roosevelt is making a number of trips to Hanna's hotel in the Waldorf Astoria to kind of court this very important man in the Republican Party.
And how does Roosevelt get away, or maybe he doesn't, is he pointed out for leaving the city to find the fresh breezes because he's got a lot of money when the heat wave strikes? In many of those days, he's not around, really.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, part of it is that he's feeling a little ill during the heat wave. But a lot of it is simply, it's not just an elitist thing that, well, if you have an estate on Long Island, like Roosevelt and other wealthy people do, you go out there and you keep your family there, not because you're somehow looking down on the city, but really, if you have a family, staying in the city risks your family's lives, not just from the heat, but from periodic cholera epidemics or tainted food and tainted milk and tainted water. So really, people don't look down on Roosevelt as, oh, he's an elitist, removing himself from the city during the height of the heat wave. This is what you do. Even if you're middle class, you try to go out to Coney Island if you can. It's really the very poorest of New Yorkers who don't have any means available to do this.
I think you cite a statistic in the book of the number of people who left New York during the heat wave, and it was quite substantial.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. Sometimes it seems during these heat waves or during cholera epidemics in the 19th century that many, the streets sometimes seem empty. As many people as possible that leave do leave. It is the time of 6-day work weeks. And so really Sundays are the only days that people have off. And it's during the heat wave that the Sunday during the heat wave, it's when Coney Island has its biggest day of its existence, that so many of even middle class people catch the special trolleys that have been established to take people directly from the city right to the coast at Coney Island. And so it's a banner day for Coney Island. And it's part of the growth of Coney Island as this great New York getaway spot.
What about the growth of charities? You talk about New York Tribune's Fresh Air Fund, which placed children with families in other parts of the East for the summer. Did those start as a result of this heat wave, or had they been around?
They'd been around already. The Fresh Air Fund had just started. There are also charities that responded to the heat wave in terms of having ice giveaways. The New York Herald was one of the newspapers that sponsored this and would establish, based on donations, especially given by individuals, individual readers of $1, $2, they established, before Theodore Roosevelt championed the idea, ice stations to give away free ice. And so this gives you an idea that the heat did already create its own special problems in summers, in cities, in the United States in the 19th century, but it was still only private charities that had done anything at all to respond to this up to this point.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine those distribution of ice places were absolutely mobbed.
Absolutely, and this is exactly what Roosevelt's experience was. It was his police who were responsible for the city distribution of ice after he championed the idea to the mayor, and Theodore Roosevelt personally supervised this distribution. And, you know, he talked about these long lines of people waiting for the ice, maybe a couple thousand people at a single precinct house, to get what it was in the end, a very still limited supply of ice. So within maybe 20 minutes or half an hour, all of the ice distributed in these large 10-pound blocks were given away. So lots of people went away without ice, despite Roosevelt's best intentions.
And what about William Jennings Bryan? Did he talk about what he saw? Did he see what was going on?
He saw what was going on. He couldn't have missed it. You know, stopping in all of these big cities along the way, you know, stopping in Chicago, whose headlines about the plight of the tenement poor and people collapsing in the street were very similar to the headlines of places like New York, as well as Cleveland, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. Bryan absolutely, while he might not have had intimate contact like Roosevelt did, Bryan was not going around, touring the tenement districts like Roosevelt was. I mean, this was the front page story of the day, as much as Bryan's trip to New York City to give the speech at Madison Square Garden.
And yet other cities had the heat wave, too. It would be unnatural for him to talk about it in Chicago, which had deaths from the heat wave, or along the train. Why did he miss this?
Yeah, I mean, Bryan, by this point, he's really, in many ways, a one-trick pony.
Wow.
He is an advocate for the United States to back the dollar, the paper dollar, using both gold and silver. America was on the gold standard at that point, and he wanted to loosen up the money supply, especially so farmers could get a little bit more credit, so they could have a little bit of inflation to get more better prices for their produce. And this is what he's running on. This is kind of the same note that he's striking over and over and over at all these small towns along his routes in Chicago, in Pittsburgh, in Madison Square Garden at that rally in New York City. He sticks to this come hell or high water or hot weather.
Mm-hmm. And Chicago experienced, it was an urban center, not big as New York. Why were the deaths fewer in Chicago than they were in New York?
I mean, a lot of it just has to do with the different experiences of the two cities by the end of the 19th century. Most immigrants who are coming to the United States are, of course, at this point, coming to Ellis Island. And
mm-hmm.
Many of them decide to stay in New York City. You know, Chicago is still about 1,000 miles away, so it's a bit of a trek to get there. Also, density, the population density down in the tenement districts on the Lower East Side in New York City are some of the highest in the world at this point, even higher than places like London. And so this is exactly why not only are the deaths in Manhattan worse than in places like St. Louis or Chicago, but even just across the river from Brooklyn. I mean, Brooklyn, still an independent city for a couple more years at this point, is very proud of the fact that their death rate is so much lower during the heat wave than New York City. But still in Brooklyn, there's still open places. There's still green areas. There hasn't been the huge population density buildup like has happened down the Lower East Side, just mm-hmm. across the river.
And you talk about the fact that the country really didn't learn anything from this horrendous heat wave and all of the deaths for some 20 years, that policies really didn't change.
I think maybe this is the nature of heat waves even still today, that we don't take them very seriously as natural disasters. They don't strike in a single moment. There's no property damage. There are no dramatic photos of what a heat wave looks like. So I think heat wave disasters tend to slip from our collective consciousness very easily. These 1,300 people died over 10 days, not in an instant when a tornado hit or a flood hit or a hurricane hit. And so, one of the things that's done is the streets are flushed. You know, basically a hose is taken and washing down the streets on the Lower East Side to bring down the temperatures of the searing asphalt. That's repeated for a few years after that. But as you say, for about 20 years, The city does not once again give away free ice, and it's doing it, you know, by 1919 at a time when electric refrigeration is beginning to be adopted, you know, in some households in the city. So it's a very late time to be doing this.
You cite in your book, heat waves will continue to be the most deadly natural killer in the United States, killing on average more Americans than floods, earthquakes, tornadoes, and hurricanes combined. I don't think we believe that.
No, absolutely. Think about this past summer, the way that heat waves have been depicted on your local media. We all see pictures of children frolicking in fountains and eating ice cream. It's like a heat wave is a holiday instead of actually a very scary, serious disaster that strikes people, but it strikes people very quietly. Back in February, the President of the United States referred to the Great Blizzard as Snowmageddon. It was a disaster that in the end killed only two people. I can't even imagine how many, probably hundreds, if not thousands of people have died in the United States this summer because of the heat. And I'm afraid that still these are going to be forgotten victims of natural disaster because we just don't pay attention to them the way we do victims of other more grandiose or obvious disasters.
And the cities are getting warmer. There are a lot of cities that had record heat and have, as you trace the past 10 years. Do you worry about this problem becoming even worse?
Absolutely. I mean, the World Meteorological Society says that over the next 20 years, heat wave deaths are going to double. So absolutely, the fact that we have air conditioning, electric refrigeration, I think lulls us into this sense of false security. Back in 1995, as many of your Wisconsin listeners will remember, 700 people died in Chicago during the 1995 heat wave. In 2003, in the European heat wave, perhaps as many as 50,000 people died.
Yeah, 50,000 from the heat. Isn't that extraordinary?
That's right. And this isn't, you know, a developing country. This wasn't Shanghai or Mumbai. This was in developed Western industrial countries. Look what's happened in Moscow over the past summer. We've seen lots of images about the fires and smoke in Moscow, which is very dramatic. But a couple weeks ago, the Moscow city government said, oh, and by the way, the death rate has perhaps doubled during the heat wave. Maybe as many as 300 people a day for weeks die during the Moscow heat wave. And this is something that we just haven't heard much of.
So what do we need to do to keep that from happening now? And what needed to be done back in 1896?
Well, thankfully, most cities now, including Chicago and New York, do have heat wave response plans in place before summers roll around. So they open up cooling centers and community centers, and they do have door-to-door and often phone calls to the people who are most vulnerable, the sick and elderly. But I still think there is this great gap in our awareness. I think both media, government, perhaps even schools need to have more awareness of the dangers of heat, what you need to do to avoid becoming a victim of the heat. Look at it's the end of August in the United States now, which means things like music festivals and state fairs and preseason football practice at high schools and colleges around the country. And I think every year it seems some poor teenager is literally practiced to death in the same way that New Yorkers were worked to death back in 1896.
Right. I've always wondered why schools can open without air conditioning. Most of them don't have it. They do in the South now, have to, but at this time of year, because it can be so, so hot, how can you study? How can you do much of anything other than try to think about getting cool?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we certainly welcome phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. Our guest is the author of Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. Our guest is Edward Cohn. And we have lines open right now. He's assistant professor of American history and chair of the American Culture and Literature Department at Bill Kent University in Ankara, Turkey. And he's joining us by phone from Ankara today. We're looking not only at this heat wave, which made and perhaps broke the careers of two very famous young politicians in the time, Theodore Roosevelt and William Jennings Bryan. But it also, from what we learned or didn't learn from that time, has ramifications for how we deal with natural disasters, namely heat, in subsequent decades. We certainly welcome your phone calls, or you can send us an email as well. The email address is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org is the email address. The phone number, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Edward Cohn is our guest. His book is Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896, and The Making of Theodore Roosevelt. We go to your phone calls, starting with Judy from Madison. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I'm wondering if your guest knows if any cities have put in more shade trees or more parks or other green spaces as a response to heat waves, as a way of creating cooler green islands for people to seek refuge from the hot sun.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things that characterized lower Manhattan during 1896, if you look at maps from that time, below Central Park, there is virtually no parks. There's virtually no green space. I don't think too many cities have changed their architecture or their city planning too much in response to heat waves. You know, we've all seen the pictures of rooftop green spaces where they're growing grass, and I think those are very important things. Absolutely. I mean, the reason cities are hotter today is because of the very architecture of cities. I completely agree. We need more trees. We need more green spaces. We need to mitigate the effects of pollution in the air in cities that traps the heat, the architecture of cities, all this asphalt and concrete that absorbs and reflects the heat. Cities are the perfect greenhouses, and absolutely we need to do more to alleviate this.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Judy, very much for the call. Also, just access to water. I've always wanted, the number of swimming pools, public pools, keeps going down because people go to water parks even in big cities now. But the therapeutic qualities of cool water and immersing yourself in that in the summer cannot be overstated.
That's right. Now, and just to add to that, if you have the time before the next call, one of the few things available for the poor in 1896 is in the rivers around Manhattan. They actually had what were called floating baths, which were simply these large wooden frames that were placed directly in the river water. And so it was. These were for hygienic reasons, that this might be the only way the poor could afford to have a bath. And, of course, during the heat wave, a lot of people did try to seek relief in this water. Water, of course, which was part of some of the most highly traveled commercial shipping traffic in the world. So I'm not sure which is better or worse, to be suffering through the heat wave or immersing yourself in this filthy, dirty water.
Oh, my. Our number, 800-486-8655. We have an email that has come in. Dave, who couldn't stay on the line, but wanted to know more about the process of obtaining and storing ice back in the 19th century, Professor Cohn.
Yeah, that's exactly why a guy from Maine would be the one to come down. I mean, this is where a lot of the ice was quite literally harvested from lakes, from rivers. You would then put it on a ship, pack it with a lot of wood chips and hay, and ship it down to docks that were actually reserved for some of these companies, ice docks. The ice would be unloaded and would be stored not in a refrigerated place, but probably just as far down below the ground as they could, again, packing it and insulating it as much as possible, waiting for the worst days of summer to come along. And then you would contact your local ice merchant, and about a 10-pound block of ice would be delivered to your door by an ice wagon.
It wasn't that long ago. You're talking about this, and when you think about it, it just wasn't that long ago, was it?
No, not really. I mean, the past 100 years, when you think about the changes that have taken place, not just in terms of, okay, we have electricity now, but the changes in working and living conditions and the laws that have been passed, in the social safety net that has been established, and whether you're talking about the New Deal and Social Security in the 1930s or Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, it's amazing how, yeah, in a very short time, we've come an enormous way.
Let's go to Judy in Milwaukee. Hello, Judy.
Hello. I was in Bangkok at the beginning of May, and the average temperature was about 105 every day, which is fairly typical with 100% humidity and no breeze at all. Do people who live in those climates just acclimate to it, or do hundreds of thousands of people die because of the heat?
I think it's a little bit of both. Think about the kind of clothes that people even in Saudi Arabia wear. I mean, in Riyadh or in Kabul or in Baghdad, I think people do change their habits and change what they wear in ways that we don't, thinking that, well, I can always duck into an air-conditioned theater for a couple hours. At the same time, for the same reason that I think in 1896 this is such a forgotten disaster, because it's the poorest that die, because they die quietly and they die slowly without too much muss and fuss, I bet in Bangkok, in Shanghai, in Mumbai, in Mexico City, I bet there are, as you say, thousands of people who die every summer, and it's just not reported on. This is a quiet disaster that hits the most voiceless in our society, and I bet in all societies.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We haven't talked very much about the animals. There were a lot of reports of dead horses in the street, and people were worried about health hazards because of dead animals.
Yeah, it's another thing that's hard for us to imagine, perhaps, is a time when the backbone of urban transportation were horses. I mean, private carriages and any kind of transportation, above-ground public trolleys that were pulled by horses. Horses suffered tremendously during the heat. They dropped dead in their harness, and if you were the horse's owner, you would simply unhook the harness and move your overloaded cart away and leave it for the city to cart away the carcass of this dead horse. The problem was there were so many, hundreds, thousands of dead horses littering the streets during the heat wave that the city contractor who was responsible for this simply couldn't keep up with the demand. So that by the end of the heat wave, news reports were saying that probably every city block had at least one dead horse.
Oh my gosh.
You know, lying on the searing asphalt in this blistering heat, sometimes for days, which absolutely, by the end of the heat wave, just added a whole new layer of pestilence and a whole new health concern.
It just sounds hellish, doesn't it?
It was like a little snapshot of hell. You know, people falling from the rooftops, traffic jams caused by all the funeral processions, a shortage of caskets in the city, dogs being gunned down in the street by police officers because people thought they were mad and had rabies when simply they were just salivating heavily at the mouth because it was so hot.
Oh, my. All right, let's move to the political fortunes of both William Jennings Bryan and Theodore Roosevelt. What happened to them in the years immediately after and then down the road a bit from 1896?
Well, Bryan, of course, comes to the city. He gives this speech in Madison Square Garden when it is excruciatingly, dangerously hot inside this packed auditorium. He decides to read his speech from a manuscript. He's one of the greatest orators in American history, and people did not come to Madison Square Garden to hear a prepared academic treatise. So within a few minutes, thousands of New Yorkers took to the exits and left. Even the most sympathetic Democratic papers in the country afterwards said this speech was an absolute failure. Bryan is forbidden from taking a further campaign trip through New England afterwards and is sent into seclusion at a private residence in upstate New York, leaving the field to McKinley and the Republicans. Of course, McKinley wins the election. Theodore Roosevelt, who helps campaign for him, does received the award reward as the position of Assistant Secretary of the Navy in Washington, D.C., a position that he resigns 2 years later at the outbreak of the Spanish-American War.
And tell me what it was. Did you read something about this, Summer? What was it that captivated you about this and made you look at this not only as a human tragedy but as a political story as well?
Yeah, I've been researching Theodore Roosevelt's early political career in New York for a number of years and publishing articles mainly in scholarly journals. And I've really been trying to explode this Western mythology that I think is built up around Roosevelt. And I've been trying to place him back where I think he belongs, and that's in a New York context, including the time when he was police commissioner. And I simply came across a letter that he wrote to his sister right at the end of the heat wave saying, what an interesting week it's been. We've had two big events. William Jennings Bryan came to town and gave this speech. And we had this terrible, what he called the heated term. And he talked about giving away ice. So as a historian, I thought, wow, what an interesting convergence of events and this 1896 election and Roosevelt and Bryan and this heat wave maybe is just a backdrop. But as I started looking at the heat wave and realizing that nothing had ever been written on it, I thought, my gosh, this is a real great disaster that nobody has ever looked at. And it did have, you know, real effects on the future of American history.
And what was, I was thinking about Bryan following a script rather than he was the greatest orator of his time. What was he thinking?
I think he was thinking that he was coming to New York City, a place that he himself had referred to as the enemy's country. That's a great way to win, you know, win over
exactly.
votes in New York or really any place, east, any big city east of the Mississippi. And I think he was worried that his words would be taken out of context by the New York press. People had already called him a demagogue, a socialist, and so he wanted to come to New York in many ways the same way that Lincoln had come to New York and given his famous speech at Cooper Union, which had helped catapult Lincoln to kind of a national reputation. But, you know, this was a terrible tactical mistake by Bryan. He gives away his greatest tools, which is his off-the-cuff oration filled with biblical imagery. This is how he won the nomination just the month before, with the Cross of Gold speech, one of the most famous speeches in American history, and he decides to do away with this when he gets to New York. A huge mistake by Bryan.
It sure was. The other thing that we didn't mention, and it's an indication of Theodore Roosevelt's days being up in New York, was this saloon closing crusade that he had to conduct.
That's right, and this is exactly why he is, by the summer of 1896, perhaps the most unpopular man in New York City. Roosevelt is an urban reformer, and the crux of so much of the corruption in the city is the police department. And they use this saloon closing law that says you have to have your saloons closed on the Sabbath, on Sunday. They use this law that most people ignore. They apply it whenever they want to. So if it's a Tammany politician, of course, the saloon is left open. But right next door, they go to the saloon keeper and say, well, we have to close your saloon unless you pony up $100. Roosevelt realizes when he becomes police commissioner that even though he thinks the law is a terrible idea, he has to enforce it. It is the law, and it has to be enforced fairly across the board. Doesn't matter what your political affiliations are. By the summer of 1895, Roosevelt has closed about 97% of the saloons, stopping the flow of about 3 million glasses of beer on Sundays, making Roosevelt especially unpopular with large immigrant groups like the Irish and the Germans.
Right, who like a little beer on Sunday afternoon.
Now, who doesn't?
Yeah, I guess you're right. And you say you found this letter that he wrote to his sister. Did Teddy Roosevelt, in subsequent years, devote more thought or words to 1896 summer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he becomes, after his famous charge up the San Juan Heights at the head of the Rough Riders during the Spanish-American War, the minute he steps off the boat back in New York, he's offered the nomination for the governorship. And during his 2 years as governor, one of the things that he consistently champions is tenement reform. And he does this in a number of different ways, absolutely, I think, influenced by the sights and sounds and smells of the summer of 1896. And absolutely, this is, I think, one of the things that helps contribute to his progressive presidency, saying that the government is responsible for alleviating the plight of the poor. The President of the United States is the top official responsible for doing these things. And it's the Progressive Era that really paves the way for so much of the government involvement in people's lives and the social safety net that marks the development of American history in the 20th century.
Well, the book certainly does change our image of him, doesn't it? And gives him, puts him in this city environment, and you're right, we do think of him as the rough rider that taking the trips everywhere, the guy who goes climbs the hills, and it really broadens our understanding of him.
That's right. You know, he'd only spent about 2 years out west playing at being cowboy. By the time he becomes police commissioner, by the summer of 1896, he spent about 15 years in Republican politics, especially in New York City. So this is the urban, especially New York context, that makes more sense when trying to evaluate, well, what's his later domestic policy? What's his later foreign policies? It has very little to do with being a cowboy in the Dakota Territory. It's about what he did in the East, especially in New York City.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Edward, for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Edward Cohn, K-O-H-N, and the book is Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896, and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.